3 minutes after 9 o'clock here in the morning in Berkeley in the West. The reason we were hurrying a little bit through that last conversation about Pacifica is that we wanted to keep it down to a time where we could rebroadcast it. Some of you may have tuned in late. Some of you may have just tuned in and have no idea what I'm talking about. But the four people, two board members and a staff member and attorney that we just interviewed about the actual current circumstance of KPFA and Pacifica and our bills and our legal situation, we're going to rebroadcast that in 1 hour here in its entirety. So those of you who only heard part of it or who may have missed it entirely, or perhaps you can call someone up who is interested in this or you think you should be interested in this and tell them to tune in at 10:30 when we'll be rebroadcasting this in its entirety. We will also be rebroadcasting it at 5:30 this afternoon. 5:30 this afternoon for those who don't wake up early. And speaking of things that are coming on this afternoon, at 6:30 tonight, we are going to be having a special commemorative broadcast about the firestorm in the Oakland-Berkeley Hills that took place a year ago. That'll be at 6:30 tonight. And at 2:30 this afternoon, once again, actually at 2 o'clock from 2 to 5 this afternoon, we're live from in front of Oakland City Hall for the big commemoration and celebration of Barbara Lee, which will be taking place from 2 to 5 in front of Oakland City Hall this afternoon, live on KPFA. Right now, live on KPFA from one of the hotspots in the world, the State of Israel and the occupied territories of Palestine, we're joined by longtime San Francisco Chronicle columnist, I guess you can't call him a columnist. He's kind of a roving reporter, author of a number of books as well. A man who's been in many conflicted zones and is now in another one, Frank Viviano. Good morning, Frank. Thanks for joining us.
How are you?
Hanging in there. Can we hear you well? Let's get your voice again.
Okay.
That sounds good.
Do you hear me?
Yes, we can, Frank. Okay. It's a little shaky. We've had some trouble getting through to you there. Frank Viviano, you arrived in the Middle East, what, about a week or 10 days ago? You've been in Egypt. You've been now in
About a month ago.
Was it a month ago? Okay, time flies when you're having fun, huh? You're now in Israel for the past few days. There's been an increasingly tense situation there, which, of course, is linked in all kinds of ways to what's going on further east from there in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and beyond in all the border countries. What can you tell us about the situation there in Israel and in the Israeli-occupied territories at the present moment?
Well, unfortunately, I think that the Palestinians and the Israelis are involved at the moment in the most serious escalation of violence on both sides probably in the last 10 years. Since Ariel Sharon's visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque almost exactly a year ago, there's been a succession of trade-offs of targeted assassinations leading up to the assassination of the tourism minister last Wednesday. And now the Israeli army has gone in a very, very serious way into the West Bank, particularly with tanks. 20 people have been killed in the last 4 days, and there's no end in sight.
Well, you in your San Francisco Chronicle piece today report that Yediot Ahronot, the Hebrew language daily newspaper, said last week that Ariel Sharon told his cabinet, "As far as I'm concerned, the era of Arafat is over." What does that mean?
Well, there's been a struggle in the Israeli coalition, which is a very unwieldy political marriage in any case, ever since it was founded a year ago when Sharon was elected with not a large enough majority for the right to rule alone, and the Labor Party joined in the coalition, the National Unity Coalition, and between the position of Shimon Peres, former prime minister and now foreign minister, and Ariel Sharon, there are so few points of connection, it's hard to understand how they can function as a single government. Peres has wanted to meet with Arafat to try and move things back toward peace. Sharon has prevented him from doing so on several occasions by simply ordering him not to. Now, most recently, yesterday in fact, Peres has announced that he there's no reason why he has to listen to the prime minister. If he wants to meet with Arafat, he will. The problem is whether or not Arafat himself any longer has the sufficient following in the Palestinian street to deliver a peace, even were the Israelis to seek one out seriously.
Well, Frank, without getting further into the really, really difficult to decipher politics of what goes on inside the Israeli governments with Netanyahu now operating to the further right of the man who one would have thought a while ago was the furthest rightist you could get in power, Ariel Sharon, and on the Palestinian side with Yasser Arafat either in control or not in control of some of the dissident militarized forces in Palestine. One of the things I was interested in talking to you about today is you have traveled extensively in the Balkans and in other regions, and I'm sure you're familiar with the school of thought which says that what's going on right now in Pakistan and Afghanistan is not limited to that region at all, that it's part of a much broader and wider movement, philosophical, hardline approach to how the world could and should be ruled under what is generally referred to under the rubric of Islamic extremism. What's your take on the connection between what goes on in all of the Muslim world, really, and what's happening now in Afghanistan with Osama bin Laden?
Well, bin Laden himself didn't really make an overt connection with the situation in the Middle East until very recently. In fact, I think his last public pronouncement was the first time that he addressed the issue at all. But certainly in the minds of ordinary people all over the Middle East, all over the Muslim world, there is a connection in the sense that he has voiced the sense of humiliation and frustration among the mass of people in the Muslim world, a sense that has been growing particularly in the Middle East ever since 1967. I think in the West we fail to appreciate the deep psychological wounds that were sustained by Muslims because of their humiliation in 1967 and what appears to have been the near permanent loss of so much land, which has only exacerbated the problem of dislocated Palestinians. I mean, at that juncture in 1967, you had a generation and a half of people who had been in refugee camps that are spread all over the place out here. Now it's been third generation. You have three generations who were born and raised in those camps. They have almost no work. They're desperate. They have no sense of themselves. And their desperation has spread to people living slightly more normal lives in big cities like Cairo, for example, or Amman. And it's a wound that has festered and festered and festered, and no one has done anything about it. No one has done anything about it in the Arab world or Muslim world either, I should add. In the Arab street, the sense of contempt for the current regimes that govern most Arabs and most Muslims is nearly as great as the sense of contempt and hatred for Israel, and by extension for the United States.
Well, what I'm, you know, one of the things I appreciate most about your writings over the years, Frank Viviano, and also in the conversations we've been able to have when we're able to be in the same place at the same time, which is all too rarely, is that you tend to tell the truth about what really goes on, not government-to-government relationships, but what's going on the ground. And I remember a series of reports you wrote from the Balkans area, and other reports that other people have now written from Afghanistan and Pakistan, and you may be on your way there if you're really unlucky, I don't know, about how things really operate, and that this is not a question so much in many regions of religiously organized so-called fanatics or government policies, but it's more a very chaotic and very self-interested series of business relationships between small cliques of people, be they ethnically oriented or oriented across ethnic lines by interests in dealing things like drugs and guns and women, rather than government policies or, as I said, ethnic solidarity, that there's a really chaotic series of relationships driven by what you might call business that underlie a lot of what's going on right now.
Well, yeah, because I think for the West, and the United States is not the only guilty party in this, short-term stability has always been the principal driving force in Middle Eastern policy, and the French, as I say, are just as guilty as the Americans, the British, everyone. And if you look only at the question of short-term stability, then it makes sense, for example, to support the regime in Saudi Arabia. On the other hand, if you're thinking long-term stability, you should recognize that regime is not very solid and that our relationship to it is based strictly on a business question. Will they be able to deliver the oil? And you're right, Larry. I mean, there's an entire constellation now of political commitments that the West has made to regimes that stretch across Central Asia and the Middle East, chiefly because of oil. You know, and I think, you know, we have to be a little real politic about this ourselves. It's true that Western civilization at the present moment can't survive without oil, and so it's not surprising that they would construct a policy that ensures the movement of oil from its sources to its markets in the West. On the other hand, in the long term, they're going to get burned, and they're going to get burned badly, because if these regimes topple because of their own corruption or because of the tremendous pressures that have emerged within those societies over the last 30 years or so, then we're not going to have the oil, and we're going to have some pretty rich and determined enemies as well.
Well, we already have some pretty rich folks getting richer and richer, as you, I'm sure, have seen living, as you do most of the time, in Paris, and I've been reading the French press, as I always do, online. There's been abundant coverage there, but also in the United States, in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, about the fact that the region where most of the conflict is now going on, i.e. northeast Afghanistan, is a region that's awash in heroin dealers, heroin growers, opium, guns, etc., and that what's going on there is basically that people who are strong enough to gain control, whether it's under the banner of an ethnicity or a country or whatever, are literally making out like bandits, you might say, and this has almost nothing to do with government-to-government relationships.
No, and in fact, one of the terrifying developments in the last 10 years or so, that is since the collapse of the Soviet Union, is the degree to which groups that style themselves national liberation movements, and some of which actually have their origins in legitimate national liberation movements, have become almost indistinguishable from racketeering and mafia organizations. They work with them because it's necessary, for example, if you produce heroin or you produce opium, to have it refined and then transported. You can't do that without the assistance of organized crime in the former Soviet Union. And what's more, many of the regimes that exist there either tacitly operate in conjunction with these organized crime groups, or are quite openly in cahoots with them. And so you have a kind of vicious circle in which organized crime feeds on the unrealized expectations and hopes of people who support these national liberation movements. The national liberation movements themselves, because they no longer have a source of funds for buying arms or supporting themselves with the collapse of the Soviet Union and America's withdrawal of support from some of them, they turn to the organized crime groups because they have no choice. I mean, it's quite a mess out there, and you're right. It doesn't have the clean, simple, easy to understand form of government-to-government relationships, whether they be positive or negative relationships. It's absolute chaos.
Well, it may be absolute chaos, but it's presented in the United States halls of government in Washington as either you're with us or you're with them. This is a war against terrorism, a war we're going to win. We're going to jump in there and take out Al-Qaeda and or Osama bin Laden and the Taliban, and then we'll have a wonderful world to live in again. This kind of simplistic thinking inevitably is going to lead to a rather colossal, shattering defeat, no matter what happens in Afghanistan. And the implications of this are going to be felt where you are right now in Israel, but also where you've spent a lot of time in the past few years, the Balkans.
Well, the Balkans already is one of the principal sources of organized crime, trafficking in human beings, in narcotics, and in arms. I mean, it's hard to imagine it could get any worse than it is presently. And it's interesting to point out, in terms of our selection of allies over the years, we have a terrible record going all the way back to the Vietnam War and before, is the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army, which is now wreaking havoc in Macedonia, and I'm sure is going to present continued difficulties in Kosovo itself, is nothing more than a drug and people smuggling ring. We presented them as the heroes of the conflict, and I suppose, in a way, asked the question that you've just asked the American government, or rather, posed the premise that you've just posed, which is that either we support these heroic defenders of liberty in Kosovo against the Serbs, or we're against the right things in humanity. And that's a terrible distortion of reality. Now, I have to say that we may have learned a lesson from that or from some of these other experiences, because it's quite clear that the United States is holding the Northern Alliance at arm's reach because they recognize that these guys are not sweethearts. Part of that is because the Pakistanis have made it known and known in certain terms that they could be worse than the Taliban when it comes to the abuse of human rights in Afghanistan. So I think that they're searching very hard to come up with a combination for the post-war political complexion of Afghanistan that doesn't simply dump it all into the laps of these guys.
And we should add that in a country where you've spent a great deal of time, your country of your ancestors, Italy, I've read reports that the Kosovo Liberation Army and other people supposedly associated with it have become so strong through the immigration of refugees from that part of the world, Albania and the surrounding territories of the former Yugoslavia, that they've now even pushed the mafia out of the drug business in large parts of Italy, and it's been taken over by people from Albania and around there.
I almost wish that that were true, but it isn't.
Yeah, the mafia is still strong enough to withstand.
I think that they've parceled out activities to some of these groups. You know, if you have as much money as the Sicilian mafia earned from its near monopoly on worldwide heroin trafficking in the 1960s and 70s, the billions and billions of dollars that they had, and the billions that they've made since then through illegal financial schemes of every imaginable sort. Why should you risk your skin running a prostitution ring or a heroin ring in Milan? Let the Kosovar do that. Let the Albanians do that. Let them do the dirty business while you just sit back and organize things, supervise them. You know, the thing about the Sicilian Mafia is they have access to a first-world infrastructure in a first-world educational system and people with the skills to engage in highly sophisticated, computer-driven, global businesses. And most of the other mafia groups don't have that infrastructure, don't have that skill. What they have is human beings who, to make money fast, are willing to risk their lives and do things that most of us would regard as inhuman. So I think that many, many times in the 150 years of its known existence as a force in organized crime, the Sicilian Mafia has been written off as dead, and it's always returned to the scene in a far more virulent and effective form, and I think that that's happening today. People speak today already, not of the Cosa Nostra, but of the Cosa Nuova, the new thing.
Frank Viviano, I'm sure you'll continue to follow that perilous path for us, as you have for so many years, writing for the San Francisco Chronicle, currently in Israel. I don't want to give away any national security secrets by asking you where you're going next, but we'll find out by reading the paper. Thank you very much for joining us here on KPFA on Sunday Salon today, Frank Viviano.
Thank you, Larry.
And apologies to our listeners for the quality of that telephone connection, but we tried for 3 hours to get through, and we had to keep the one that we finally got when we finally got it. It is 7 minutes before 10 o'clock in the morning. Stay tuned. At the 10 o'clock hour, we're going to be talking to people about local politicians here in Berkeley and Oakland and their response to what's been going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we have much more coming up, including a rebroadcast of the half hour that you may have missed at 9 o'clock, in which we deal with the current Pacifica situation. Stay tuned. We are back here live on Sunday Salon. I'm Larry Bensky, here with you every Sunday from 9 to 11, sometimes just hanging on by the tips of my little fingers as I was last week, but it's a little better this week. And thank all of you for your very supportive emails and telephone calls. I don't know where we'd be without you. Yes, I do know where we'd be without you. We'd be off the air a long time ago. A few events coming up in the next few hours and days that I wanted to share with you here at this time. Up at the Charles Krug Winery in St. Helena, where people have been rallying for some weeks now in support of 45 locked out United Food and Commercial Workers Union workers at the Charles Krug Winery. There's a rally starting in about 10 minutes, actually, but lasting for, I'm sure, an hour or two at 11 a.m. at Lyman Park in St. Helena. That's at 11 o'clock this morning. It's not a few minutes. It's an hour from now. 11 o'clock, Lyman Park in St. Helena. Bay Area authors Tilly Olson and Gray Brechin will be reading there, among others. They'll also be signing books. Once again, this is sponsored by the Latino Leadership Council and the Krug Worker Support Committee, 11 a.m. this morning, Lyman Park in St. Helena. Next Saturday, October 27th in San Jose, from 9:30 to 6 at the First Unitarian Church on 3rd Street, is a day-long discussion, brainstorming session, and training in nonviolence about resisting war and defending civil liberties. Once again, this is going on in San Jose next Saturday, October 27th from 9:30 till 6. For more information, you can call an area code 408-264-4277. That's 408-264-4277, Saturday, October 27th from 9:30 to 6. First Unitarian Church of San Jose on 3rd Street in downtown San Jose. This coming Monday, tomorrow, at 7 o'clock at the Rockridge Library in Oakland, the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California presents a panel discussion on civil liberties in the aftermath of September 11th with Dr. Aga Saeed, National Chair of the Muslim American Alliance, and Heba Niemer of the ACLU. That's tomorrow, 7 o'clock at the Rockridge Library College at Manila in Oakland, the ACLU Forum. This coming Friday at the College of Marin, a talk on war, peace, and propaganda by someone who knows a lot about it, John Stauber, whose books include Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Lies, Damn Lies, and Public Relations Industry, etc. John Stauber is coming out here, and he will be appearing this Friday at the College of Marin, Friday, October 26th, in the Student Services Cafeteria, Friday the 26th, 7 p.m., War, Peace, and Propaganda, John Stauber, interviewed by Project Censored. Today at 2:30, as we mentioned, and the live broadcast starts here at 2 o'clock on KPFA, the community gathering in support of Barbara Lee at the Frank Ogawa Plaza right in front of Oakland City Hall. That's from 2 to 5 this afternoon on KPFA, and the actual rally begins at 2:30 there. And we'll be broadcasting that, as I said, in its entirety. And then at 6:30 tonight on KPFA, we'll be having a special commemorative broadcast about the Oakland firestorm, which happened just about 10 years ago and wrecked so much so-called natural havoc here in the Bay Area. That's 6:30 tonight at 94.1 FM. Also tonight at La Peña, there's a panel on nonviolence in action, resisting the occupation in Israel. Penny Rosenwasser joins us on the telephone. Good morning, Penny. Penny Rosenwasser is there. Hi, Penny.
Hi. I was just going to say it's actually an Israeli peace activist, Liad Kantrowitz, who's on a tour here with her partner, who's a U.S. filmmaker, Tyson Smith, and they're going to be showing a live-action video about different methods of nonviolence direct action that Palestinians and Israelis and internationals together have been using in the occupied territories to try to end the occupation.
So that is tonight at 7 o'clock at La Peña, 3105 Shattuck Avenue. Tell us a little bit, just if we only have a second, Penny, about the tactic and technique of nonviolence in Israel. It would seem, from what we see on television and read in the newspapers, and we're just talking to Frank Viviano live there, that it is an extremely violent period. I've read a statistic of over 1,000 people killed in the last year, two-thirds of them Palestinians, in the continuing explosions, shootings, assassinations, what have you. What are nonviolent people doing in a circumstance like that?
Well, it's actually, gained a lot of power there. One of the things they've been doing is what's called the Human Shield Project, and folks who listen to KPFA heard about that in August, where, for example, Israeli and peace activists and internationals went into the West Bank town of Beit Jala and stayed in homes with Palestinians and effectively kept many of the Israeli soldiers from shooting into those homes, so acting as a shield between the Palestinian people and protecting them. That's the kind of thing they do, also bringing food supplies, milk, bread through the Israeli lines and sieges and blockades to feed the Palestinians. So it really has an effect. And the other thing is it also has really raised the morale of Palestinians and Israelis in the peace movement. They've told me that personally. And it's gotten international media where other actions by the peace movement haven't. So it both provides concrete help and helps build this peace movement to end the occupation.
Well, I must say, some of the bravest people that I ever met in my travels around the planet were in Nicaragua in the late 80s and early 90s, the Witness for Peace people who went to the front where the United States-supported Contras were involved in so many atrocious assaults on the peasantry and tried to impose themselves in between those people. They're very dedicated and very brave people.
This is very similar to the Witness for Peace. And just as your guest mentioned earlier, it's such a horrendous time there right now. 21 Palestinians have been killed in the last 4 days, including a mother of eight. A 10-year-old girl in her school was killed, and she died in her sister's arms. Another pregnant Palestinian mother died at a checkpoint when the soldiers wouldn't let her through. And Liad Kantrowitz, who is Israeli and American, will be talking more about that tonight. So it's a really good opportunity for people who don't have a lot of information to learn more. I'd also really urge anyone who's listening to please contact our legislators and tell them that this country has to pressure Sharon to stop this. I just got an email from a Methodist clergywoman there who said it's going to be a veritable bloodbath if this is not stopped immediately.
Penny Rosenwasser of the Middle East Children's Alliance, once again, that forum on nonviolence and action is tonight at La Pena, 7 o'clock, 3105 Shattuck Avenue. Thanks for joining us, Penny.
Thanks, Larry. And if I could also say it's sponsored by the East Bay Jewish-Palestinian Dialogue Group, the Middle East Children's Alliance, Jewish Voice for Peace, and Coalition of Jews for Justice.
This is KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking about elected officials and their response to the current crisis.
I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States.
On September 14th, Barbara Lee stood alone with her courageous vote against giving President Bush a free hand to take military action without consulting Congress. I'm Amelia Gonzalez.
And I'm Walter Turner, inviting you to tune in on Sunday, October 21st at 2 p.m., for KPFA's live broadcast of a community gathering to express appreciation for Barbara Lee and her courageous vote.
The event will also support the families of innocent victims, support alternatives to war, the right to principled dissent, and an end to racial profiling.
Featured speakers will include Alice Walker, Danny Glover, Maxine Hong Kingston, and KPFA's own Davey D.
So join us for a live broadcast from outside City Hall in downtown Oakland on this Sunday from 2 to 5 here on 94.1 KPFA.
Memory.
On Sunday afternoon in Blue Mountain, Mother received 17 gentlemen calls.
I am the narrator of these preludes. A crystal unicorn. A symbolic prop.
Yes.
The other characters.
17.
A man.
Gentleman.
A woman.
Caller.
Not one of them realistic.
Memories. Like thin plate glass.
A symbolic prop.
Gentlemen. Callers.
Join us October 21st at 8 p.m. for a special KPFA live presentation of The Gentleman Caller, Seven Preludes of Memory by Ellen Sebastian Chang in collaboration with Selena Allen. The Gentleman Caller, Seven Preludes of Memory, is an original play examining the fragility of memory, the fragility of desire, the fragility of the soul. The Gentleman Caller, Seven Preludes of Memory, October 21st at 8 p.m. here on KPFA.
And you are listening to 94.1 FM KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. The time here is 10:04, and this morning you are listening to Larry Bensky and our Sunday Salon. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the second hour of Sunday Salon. I'm Larry Bensky, and joined at this time by three people who are, two of them, elected officials in the communities most contiguous to us here. In fact, one of which we sit in Berkeley, the other from Oakland, and also someone who has been involved in the planning of the event that begins at 2:30 this afternoon that we've been mentioning this morning in front of Oakland City Hall, the community meeting to congratulate and celebrate Barbara Lee. Joining me from the Berkeley City Council, which has been, as it sometimes becomes, a hotbed of passion and controversy for the last couple of weeks, Linda Mayo, who represents the district that is in the extreme northwest of Berkeley, District 1. She's been a Berkeley City Council member for 10 years. Is that correct, Linda?
About nine.
9 years, but who's counting? Right.
Yeah.
Coming up on 10. Nancy Nadel has been on the Oakland City Council for how long, Nancy?
Almost 5 years.
Almost 5 years. Her district stretches from East Oakland in a kind of West Oakland in a kind of a strange configuration up eastward. And have you been affected at all by the redrawing of district lines? Is it going to change you much?
I don't think so. We're going to do that after the new year.
Hasn't been done yet in Oakland.
Hasn't been done yet.
But you have been working on this Barbara Lee event, I believe.
Yes.
One of the
co-chairs of the organizing committee.
You're a co-chair of the organizing committee. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good thing to be. Walter Riley is with us, who is an attorney in Oakland, and he is an activist who is... Are you now the chair of the Vanguard Foundation, or are you immediate past chair?
I am presently the chair of the Vanguard board.
Well, we have to thank you, among other things, for being one of the places that helps us get money to defend KPFA. You know, Vanguard is one of the places that... people donate money to support our activities and our lawsuits, so thank you for that.
Quite welcome. It's been an important part of what Vanguard is about.
He is also board chair of the East Bay Center for the Performing Arts, co-chair of the John George Democratic Club, and my heart beats a little bit every time I say the word John George because he was such a great man and such a great friend to us here in his years as an Alameda supervisor. And he's vice chair of the Alameda County Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Commission. Any political act that any politician or elected official takes at a time like this is subject to controversy, of course. The Berkeley City Council passed a resolution the other night after a long and stormy session, which followed another long and stormy session, which has been followed and preceded by long and stormy emails and telephones and newspaper articles. Linda Mayo is a member of that Berkeley City Council. She voted in the majority, the 5-4 majority of the so-called progressives over the so-called moderates. At least that's the way they're usually broken down. Linda, what's going on over there? You just put in front of me a cartoon from the Oakland Tribune this morning. I don't know if it's original. Yes, it is original, the MANG newspapers, which shows a drawing of Osama bin Laden wearing a Berkeley City Council T-shirt.
Yeah.
Is that somewhat typical of some of the ignorant response you've been getting?
It's pretty typical, and it's largely, entirely, I would say, due to the fact that the media has really sensationalized this beyond belief. I've been making it clear for 2 days now, from morning till night, on the telephone and on emails, that the Berkeley City Council never voted to condemn the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan.
Why not?
That was introduced by Donna Spring and introduced for debate. Right now, the council has acted. It has certainly acted. And I will get to your question about why not, because I've been dealing with it for days now. But I do want to make it clear what the council did vote for. The council voted to ask our representatives, and this was after we condemned the 9/11 attacks and extended our sympathies to everyone who's been affected by this, and honored all of the public sector people, the police and fire departments in particular, and so many of the volunteers who responded so heroically. The city council asked our representatives to help break the cycle of violence, bringing the bombing to a conclusion as soon as possible, to avoid actions that would endanger the lives of the innocent in Afghanistan, and minimizing the risk to American troops. We have a number of other things that we stated in this resolution, but that's essentially it.
Well, what does that mean? I mean, that sounds to me like a politician waffle when you say bring the bombing to a conclusion as soon as possible, when it's George W. Bush and his administration who determine what's possible.
Exactly, and I think that that's the point. Nobody really knows This is my perspective now. Nobody really knows what's happening there and what the intelligence is. But I personally have no problem with going in and taking out aircraft and taking out military installations. I think that that's it's a reasonable response. I realize I'm not in the majority here in terms of the left, but I think it's a basic requirement. When they start moving towards cities and start indiscriminately bombing, and I really don't think they're necessarily doing that, but we have no way of knowing. But it parallels what's happening in Iraq, where we've gone in and pummeled, and we really have very little to show for it.
So what
except that we have a lot of casualties.
Well, the question
and a lot
then
of
becomes
pain and suffering.
What in the history of the United States military actions in general, and in that part of the world in particular, would lead you to think that there's any wisdom or tactic that allows the United States to do what you say you support, that is, go in and dismantle, I assume, the people who are responsible for things like the attacks on the World Trade Center? What is there that in Dick Cheney's career, and George W. Bush's, or his father's, or Donald Rumsfeld, or any of those other people that would give you the slightest confidence that they're able to do that?
I think we're putting, for me, I think we're putting that history for now aside because we're in a new era right now. We've had this tremendous attack on our country. I feel like I'm mouthing, you know, all the stuff that I've been hearing. And to simply sit back and not do anything, we could sit back and not do anything and make a tremendous investment in these countries in terms of raising their standard of living and to work peacefully with everyone around the country and everyone in the world to try to bring this thing to a conclusion. But I have to say that the American people seem to really need to have something happen where we take out at least the military apparatus. And, you know, I know that I'm alone in this, in terms of probably in this room, but...
Find out about this room. Nancy Nadel, the Oakland City Council, as far as I've been able to tell, has not received a similar resolution from anyone. I haven't heard Mayor Jerry Brown, although I probably would have a couple of years ago, and he was hosting a talk show on this station, but he's a changed person now, talking along those lines. What about that, the politics of a city and elected officials trying to take a response at this time that reflects the opinion of its citizens?
Certainly, if it reflects the opinion of the citizens, it should take that position. But it also needs to take leadership. I think one of the reasons why we're having this event today to express appreciation for Barbara Lee is that she took leadership. And leadership is very different from populism. I guess that's what sort of caught my ear when Linda was saying that the American public feels like we need to do something. And I think it's because we don't have in our tool chest a range of alternatives to doing something with our fists or our guns or our bombs. And so they don't feel like that those alternatives are effective. We haven't learned them as well as we have learned war. So I think that that's, you know, if that was part of our curriculum, if it was part of our capabilities, if we had a peace high school instead of a military high school and a peace university, we would more likely have faith in those alternatives than what we have now. We have so many centuries of fighting and just a short period of time of understanding that there are alternatives. But I don't want to lose the focus on why the city of Berkeley did what they did, which is to call attention to the fact that in 3 weeks when the snows come, if we continue bombing and food aid can't get through, we will have millions of people dying.
You already have millions of people at risk of death. We had somebody on this program last week from Oxfam who spoke to us from Pakistan who made it abundantly clear that with the bombing right now, they can't get truck convoys in.
Exactly.
And that people are already malnourished and in a possibility of plague of diseases that we think are eradicated here, like tuberculosis, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. And that's why it's the bombing is keeping that terrible condition, and I think that's that was the humanist rationale behind the Berkeley City Council's motivation to stop the bombing.
Walter Riley, you've seen some of this before. You've been on this planet just from looking at you long enough to have seen military activities by this country in a number of circumstances, and a stampeding of legislative bodies, such as we now have in Congress in Washington, to get behind the president, the military, etc. What's your take on what's going on this time?
Well, clearly, as you say, that to indicate there's a stampeding of people, the legislative bodies, Congress, elected officials, the major part of the media, to support the expanded powers of the president and an opportunity to increase the U.S. presence militarily in the rest of the world, particularly in the Middle East, forming these alliances. A move towards war, it's outrageous. There was an alternative for George Bush on 9/11, and it would have been to stand on the White House lawn and say, you know, I'm here. There's been a terrible attack, and we're going to respond to this criminal act. That this is not war, and would have been a way to approach this problem. This is not war. This is a criminal act, and we will seek out the criminals and bring them to justice. And I think it would follow. Following that approach would lead to some different scenarios than we are having right now. The president needs to be a cowboy, to talk in fifth grade terms, and to motivate people to create as much hate for a large group of people in the world, and lays the basis for the hate that occurs here in the United States, and where people of color are being attacked, particularly Indian and people from the Middle East. That kind of hatred that is so much a part of the fabric of our society when we move to try and defend any aspects of what we call the American way, we end up losing the American way. We end up losing our sense of democracy. I don't support the Taliban, and I don't support bin Laden. Those forces have been people who have worked with the U.S. government and U.S. governmental agencies for some time, and their approach has been to destabilize countries, to destroy the proper democratic fronts in the world, which has also been the role of the U.S. in the Middle East, destroying the proper democratic front. And they would kill us. They would kill us sitting in this room. But that's not to say that I can support the all-out war mobilization in this country. It just can't be the way that we approach our problems.
You know, when you say, Linda Mayo, we're in a new era now, all of that other stuff about how George Bush the First behaved when he was head of the CIA and when he was running the United States bombing of Iraq, yes. All of the things that we know about Dick Cheney and his past and Donald Rumsfeld and their oil and military connections, all of that is part of the past, and we live in a new era. What's new about this era?
Well, I don't want to whitewash any of the things that have happened before. I have to say, Larry, I'm responding from days getting phone calls and being on email, much of it filled with hate. When people learned that the action that we took, many of them wrote back, called and apologized, knowing that the media needs juice every day, and we became their juice, so they sensationalized this. What's new about it is how people are wearing this on their sleeves across the country. They're so much in pain. There's so much anger. There's so much fear. And they have no place to put it except for Osama bin Laden and the Taliban.
Why should we help them put it there?
Mm-hmm. Hang on. They're putting it here now in Berkeley because there's a place to put it.
So, does this affect you as a Berkeley citizens are doing this, or that because you're getting letters? Because I notice a lot of the emails that I get copies of and a lot of the letters to the editor come from Michigan,
come from Texas, from across the country.
They don't come from your district and my district.
There are a couple. A number of people have said,
do not
speak for me. Well, you're not getting my emails. I'm not forwarding them to you.
Thank you.
Do not speak for me. You know, because I think it's so close to the bone, people feel this so strongly. That's why we're getting such
a
strong
reaction. Took a walk yesterday with my daughter, which lasted about 3 hours through Berkeley, and one of my subtexts that I didn't tell her about because she's not even 5 years old yet, is I wanted to count flags because there was a letter from somebody who's a consultant that you probably saw in the San Francisco Chronicle for right-wing Democratic candidates threatening we're going to change the vote in the city of Berkeley. Every place you look, you see flags. I didn't see flags. I was in North Berkeley. I was in Central Berkeley. I was in South Berkeley. Yeah. I was in South Campus. Yeah, I saw a few. But I didn't see this city awash in flags. That's nonsense.
No.
That's not the majority opinion in this city. Anything
but,
like
you know,
it.
You run into people on the street who you've worked with on the left for years, and a good number of them are saying this is different this time.
Well, a good number of them are Zionists, and a good number of them aren't people on the left who were back in the Civil Rights Movement and haven't done anything ever since. I mean, we ran across this. I don't know if you remember this, Walter, and anybody else in this room. We ran across this in the Vietnam War era.
Yes.
When there were people who said, Walter, I know you remember this, who said, well, I'm with Dr. King on civil rights, but I can't go along with him as far as condemning the war in Vietnam. That's something completely different. You know, I jump off the wagon here on this. I'm, you know, for the United States military activities. Of course, we should have peace and justice here at home, but when it comes to abroad, let's go kill the commies if we have to. And that's an analogous situation in my mind to what we're going through right now.
I agree. I think that's true. One of the things that Dr. King was able to do is provide leadership. I think that's something that Nancy is talking about, something obviously that we're all talking about, what needs to be done. And in providing a leadership and taking a stand, it begins to move people and give them something to an alternative, a way of thinking, a way of approaching this thing. A lot of the left, progressives, felt that the attack on the tower somehow or another was an attack on them. On us. I think that I recognize that among my friends, and they feel that perhaps a lot more deeply than I do.
I certainly feel that way. The attack on the towers was an attack on me and my people.
And I feel that the bombing of the neighborhood in Nicaragua was an attack on me and my people. And I feel those things very, very sincerely. And I feel the attack on the towers as a horrible act, and I feel that's an attack on the country. I identify with many of the other acts of terror in ways that sometimes many of the sectors of our community and the left, the progressive community, don't necessarily see. There was not the same discussion about Nicaragua as there is about the towers. Of course, that's not here at home. But we should feel that. We should feel it very strongly, and we should react very, very, very sharply to those things because they are attacks. But we should also try and intellectualize at least what we know to be the history that we've experienced here, the need for responding to these attacks with some sense of understanding of what it means to the rest of the world, what it means to many other sectors in our country. There are many other people, groups of people in the Bay Area, in the rest of the country, that have varied reactions to what happened in the Twin Towers. And sometimes we don't necessarily take those into consideration. I just want to say, I know that taking a little bit of time, that what we're looking at is the leadership around this. And I passed out leaflets for the Barbara Lee support rally this afternoon that starts at 2:30. And I passed them out over in East Oakland. I passed out leaflets on Lake Shore. And I passed out leaflets in Berkeley. And I found tremendous responses to this leaflet. When people look at it and say, this is a rally to support the courage of Barbara Lee. Everybody took the leaflet, I believe. But there were maybe five people in the week or two that I was passing out leaflets that didn't actually accept the leaflet. But everybody thought it was an important act to take, and it's important to show support for her. And I think that says that there is a sense of understanding how our response should be developed in the Bay Area then.
Yeah, I would be amiss if I my fellow organizers for this event let that go by. We really didn't plan this as a rally. So I know Walter's used that word, but
it's
not really. It's a spiritual and cultural event, and there are very few. The only political person who's speaking is likely me and Keith.
What about Barbara Lee? Isn't she going to be there?
Well, we originally planned it thinking that she was not going to be here because we thought Congress was going to be in session, and she is in town, and we'll see what happens. But I assumed
she was going to be there. I don't know why.
The plan was that we wanted to make sure that the press saw that she represented her constituents, whether or not she could be there, and we still intend to do that. We expect to have thousands of people out there.
Well, at the same time, you know, Walter was talking about the political reaction. It's inevitable, and I frankly welcome it when people come up and take an oppositional point of view to this, because it gives us a way of measuring who's what rather than some inflammatory editorial cartoonist in the Oakland Tribune or some organized letter writers from Texas. When somebody like Audie Bach comes right out and says, I'm a patriot, Barbara Lee isn't, and therefore I'm going to run against her in the primary. Or we have another example. Who is this?
Jane Bruner.
Jane Bruner, who's running for the nomination for
Assembly 14th
Assembly,
District,
which Dionne Ehrenreich has been termed out of, and she's running against Lonnie Hancock now, I believe. And she's taken a position saying that Berkeley is out of step and its steps are troubling. Restricting firefighters from placing American flags, all the whole media,
which we never did,
which was never done.
Well, I just have a question about that. You said that person is taken out, stepping out, taking an oppositional step. Now, I just read the Jane Bruner thing. That's an oppositional position. But what is her position? Why isn't there a positive position about what she is as a patriot, as opposed to attacking the Berkeley City Council?
Well,
that doesn't seem like the role of a person in city government.
It's the role of a politician trying to win office.
Exactly. Trying to win office.
And it's so inflammatory. You know, our businesses are calling because they're being threatened with boycotts. That's not a position to take, to keep the flames going, to inflame everything.
Well, we'll see how it plays out in the voting booths. So my guess right now, if you wanted my veteran political activist's pulse-taking, would be that Audie Bach would be lucky to get 25% in a March primary in Barbara Lee's district if the issue is this particular issue. Because not only does people agree with Barbara Lee on her position, but even those who disagree with her are proud of her in some extent for speaking up and being the one person.
And I suspect Audie Bach thinks she'll get money from around the country.
Oh, I'm sure she will.
And I think we need to remember, too, that Barbara's history is on a lot of other issues as well. She's done some extraordinary things on housing lately, and just, you know, she's there on a lot of progressive issues.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure we'll hear all about that this afternoon, and right. If you can't make the rally, you can certainly turn your radio on.
The culture is not a rally.
I'm sorry, the event. What is the matter with you? Give me that leaflet. Express appreciation. That's once again
it's
going on.
It's a community gathering.
Thank you. 2:30 to 5 today in Frank Ogawa Plaza, which is right in front of City Hall in downtown Oakland. Among those who are going to be there are Alice Walker, Danny Glover, Ishmael Reed, Maxine Hong Kingston, our own embattled Davy D, and many others. And once again, if you can't be there, it'll be on the air on KPFA 94.1 FM from 2 to 5 this afternoon. Thank all of you for coming in here with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
As a UN official, I should not be expected to be silent. How long must the civilian population be exposed to such punishment for something they have never done? The words of Hans von Schwonek, former UN Assistant Secretary General and Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq, who resigned in protest of the sanctions and continued bombing of Iraq. Join him and human rights activist Kathy Kelly in a tour of Northern California between October 27th and November 2nd. Benefits Voices in the Wilderness and local social justice and anti-war organizations. Find out when they will be in your area. Call 650-321-4464 or www.peaceandjustice.org.
The new National Anti-War Coalition Answer holds a teach-in on Saturday, October 27th for historical analysis of the war, racist attacks, and the assault on civil liberties with Ilyas Rashmawi, Zulfikar Ahmad, Gloria LaRiva, Barbara Lubin, lawyers from the Emergency Campaign to Defend Dissent, and more. A $5 to $20 donation benefits Answer. That's October 27th, 4 p.m. at Mission High School, 18th and Dolores in San Francisco. Call 415-821-6545. That's 415-821-6545.
And for all you sleepyheads who may have woken up late this morning and missed our 9 o'clock discussion, we're going to do something we haven't done before on Sunday Salon. But hey, why have you got a KPFA if you can't do things you haven't done before? We're going to rebroadcast the first half hour because it is about a critical issue, the survival of KPFA and our situation, our 2.5-year-old struggle now versus the Pacifica Foundation. This is once again going to be broadcast again at 5:30 this afternoon. So if you don't quite catch it now, or you know somebody else who wants to hear it, it'll be on again at 5:30 this afternoon. Here we go. Earlier this week, word began to circulate here inside KPFA and over KPFA's airwaves and also over the Internet that there was a threat that KPFA would once again be shut down, this time because the Pacifica Foundation was either unable or unwilling to pay KPFA's bills. There are apparently some $114,000 in unpaid bills out there.